welcome to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. My name is Sean Delaney, and each week at this time I introduce you to ideas and people to stimulate your thinking about aspects of education. You can listen back to hundreds of previous episodes by going to seandelaney.com and clicking on the podcasts tab. Later on today's programme, I'll be speaking to Professor Kay Livingston from the University of Glasgow. But first, I return to last week's guest, Anja Svenjan from the University of Amsterdam. I met up with Anja Svenjan at the annual meeting of the Association for Teacher Education in Europe last August in Sweden. Anja's work is informed by the history of education, and in this part of our conversation, I asked her about her scholarly work in the history of education.
I think it's not so different from historians usually. You find a theme you like. For me, it's now the teacher education in the Second World War. But I've done a thesis about the development of the profession of teacher educators. What you do is collect as much data as you can find.
And what kind of data do you use? I mean, it's sources?
Yes, it's sources. In history, and for instance, with teacher education in the Second World War, we use memorial books.
What are memorial books?
Books like this teacher education institute exists for 25 years or 50 or 100, and they write a book about their own past. And you have a lot of them in Ireland, probably, but also in the United Kingdom. I know more about that. So these books are written by an older teacher educator or maybe an old head of the teacher educator. It's very personal. It doesn't always give a complete overview, but it is the only thing we have. So you have to learn to read them in a good way. You know, they are positive about their own past. They tell about how great they were, not what went wrong. Sometimes they do. So we use that kind of sources. Yeah.
So can you say a little bit more about the work you're doing now about teacher education in the Second World War in the Netherlands?
There were a few books and a few studies in which teacher education and the Second World War was mentioned. And I did it as well, but only a few pages. And so a historian at our own university was also interested in the topic, and we decided to join forces, which is nice, because I'm not a real historian, I'm more a teacher educator. And he's a real historian. And so we now are trying to write about what it means for teacher educators to live through tyranny. So we are not only interested in what happened in the Second World War. That's the beginning. That's the story. But we want to understand what it means when not an enemy, in the World War II, of course, it was the enemy, but if a non-democratic government, for instance, imposes upon teacher education what they have to do, to see to it that education has their vision and their ideology. So they impose their ideology on teacher education. And so I spoke to someone, the Germans did this, the Nazis, I must say, not the Germans, the Nazis, and did it in the Second World War. But I spoke to someone from Russia today, and he said it was the same from Stalin. He did the same. He gave more money to teacher education, so teacher education would become stronger and there would be teachers, good teachers maybe, but within the ideology. And I think that's very interesting.
So how did it work then in the Netherlands? How did the Nazis influence teacher education in the Netherlands?
Yeah. The war started in May 5th in 1940, and already a few months later they had a whole series of amendments, laws. I'm not sure about the English word, but you know what I mean.
Amendments is fine.
And they said things that were threatening to Germany, things that didn't comply with Nazi ideology, books or texts written by Jews, they all had to be removed from the libraries. So they worked through 900 titles that had to be removed from libraries, and they worked through textbooks, and the teachers and teacher educators, it was for education in general, and they had to remove passages. So there are examples of books, textbooks, for instance about history, where teachers had to remove often the head teachers, of course, parts of the text because the Nazis didn't like what was written there.
And how did the teacher educators respond to those requests?
They complied, yes. But that is what people do. People comply to their governments.
Because they're dependent on it for their living.
Of course, of course. And that's in general the case. Even with all the changes in teacher education, which happen with every new government, the teacher educators and the teachers comply. But of course, that's a different situation. In the war, they tried to resist, but the retaliation was so enormous and frightening that people thought, well, we'll just do what they ask us. And another important thing, they thought this will blow over. We don't have to worry too much. So when the next step was that the Jewish students and the Jewish teachers and teacher educators could no longer be at the schools, they just went. And even the Jewish teachers sometimes said, it will blow over. We won't make a fuss. It will blow over. But of course it didn't. No. No.
That's very interesting. And what other sources did you have to draw on, apart from the memorial books that you've talked about, which kind of come up, say, for certain centenaries or anniversaries in institutions?
Yes. But we also have, of course, a huge literature about Second World War. Huge. There are some studies about education in the Second World War, and there are some studies about teacher education, especially about one teacher education institute, a Protestant Teacher Education Institute in Amsterdam, and they were very much in the forefront of resistance. They managed to save a lot of babies because they could move the children from the Teacher Education Institute to a safe house, you could say, and that was a concert hall. They could move the children, and so the head teacher was one of the main people in that, but also the girls of the school, the student teachers, they brought the babies from one place to another to a safe environment in hiding or families or whatever.
And did you look at the time then, once the Nazi occupation had ended, did you look at how that affected teacher educators?
Not yet, but we know that what people wanted after the war, they wanted to be back to normal. My father, who was a student teacher during the war, so that is one of my sources, but a very different one, of course. He had to work in Germany. They rounded up all the boys and young men, and they were sent to Germany to work. And so my father was there for 9 months, 16 years old. And he says, the only thing we wanted was to be back to normal. And what I do know is that quite some schools were destroyed or they were used as for military bases, and they had to be rebuilt or the interior had to be restored or whatever. This all was done in a few months' time, remarkably. So after 1 or 2 years, everything was back to normal. But what stayed was interference of the government. That stayed.
And that's still there.
And that's still there. And that has its good and bad sides.
Of course, yes, yes.
Because the Netherlands has quite a good system for teacher education, we must be honest.
Yes, indeed. Yes. Yeah, no, I'm aware of that. Yes. I'd like to come on now to some more general questions. And the first one is, what is school for, or what are schools for?
I don't think my answer is original. But schools are there to help individual students to develop. You have to learn to read, to write. You have to learn a lot of things while you're young. You have to go to secondary education and develop yourself as a person. After that, you have to learn a profession, whatever level, vocational or university. And that means also school is there to have good citizens. And I think that is very important as well. And also, in my view, global citizens. Because I think we live in a global world. And diversity is a big issue, but the world is more diverse. And people have to learn to live together in this world, in my view. And that is one of the things that you can do in schools.
Was there a teacher who had a significant impact on you?
More than one. Yes, yes, absolutely. I once had a teacher who I, as a student, I didn't really finish some of my projects. I'm not good at needlework, and I just let my mother finish the needlework, you know, so that I had a 6 or a 7, and he spotted that, and he challenged me in that. I never forget. So that was very good, and that he dared to do that, very involved in me as well.
And how did he know? Was it because
I never finished. You know, I wanted everything, and then I started something in school, but I didn't.
But your mother finished it.
Yeah, but and he wasn't that. It wasn't that. He wasn't. He was a teacher in Dutch. So how did he know? I don't know. No, but he challenged me, and that was, I think, very good when I was 14 or 15, a teenager. But it was a good challenge. I learned from it, of course. If you want something, finish it. But I also learned to address issues with students in a good way.
You said there was more than one.
There was also a German teacher who was very good in, we call it didactiek in the Netherlands. Didactiek is pedagogy. And he was a teacher of German. So he made booklets with stories, narratives of young writers. So he looked for books and stories that would appeal to us. And also in his way of teaching, he was very modern and advanced in language learning. And I never forgot it. And I met him later when I was myself a pedagogy teacher. I met him, I could tell him how much that influenced me, that you can actually shape your pedagogy, that you have power over that. So I like that very much. And someone who influenced me very much was in teacher education. And he was very critical, very critical. I don't know if you know the work of Michael Apple.
Yes.
Yeah, and he was very much into that kind of thinking. And he even invited very young Stephen Ball to come and talk to us in class. Really? That happened at that time. That impressed me very, very much. That you could think about education in a critical way and still want to be in it and improve it. You know, be part of this and still look at it in a critical way. So he, and he learned me how to write.
Academic writing?
Academic writing, yeah. Then I wrote something and he gave it back and he says, you know, this is nothing. It's, how can you just give it to me? This is bad writing. Do it again. And I did it again. And then we discussed it and I did it again. So I learned it's academic writing is hard work.
Who or what inspires you?
So this man did, but on a personal level, I think it was also very much my father, who was a teacher educator and who studied. He was a teacher and did a lot of studying to become a teacher educator in Dutch language, like I did, but in a much easier way than he did. And also his dedication, and he tried to improve as much as he could, limited in his time, of course. Yes, for my thesis was the history. That was the bulk of the work. But I added 5 narratives to it, and one of those was my father. Yes, it was accepted.
Do you have a favorite blog or book or writer about education?
It's not one favorite, but I find the last few years, I think the work of Michael Apple very, very inspiring. Very inspiring. And
What is it about it that you find inspiring?
I think he's very involved in education. He's not only seeing what is not going well, he acts his own ideas. I don't think that's good English, but you know what I mean.
He practices what he preaches.
He practices what he preaches. And I think that's very important. Because in education, you have to practice what you preach, otherwise it's nothing. But if you do, you see how difficult it is. Because if you have to, if you try to practice to be inclusive, if you tell your students to be inclusive, it's not very difficult. I mean, you and I can have a beautiful lecture about it, how to do it. But to be inclusive in your own classroom is very, very difficult. And I think it's very important for teacher educators to discuss how difficult this is. So you say you have to be inclusive. I try. Let's discuss if I'm successful. Why is this so difficult? I try to model, but it's not always easy. And it means you also understand how difficult teaching is for students, because it's difficult for you as well. And it's also good, we call this explicit modeling, because you explain what you're doing. You share your feelings and ideas and idealism and practice with your students. And that's another inspiring person, especially from teacher education, and that's John Loughran. So people who are interested in teacher education and teacher educators should certainly read his work. And just this morning, we were talking about him, to be honest, in a very positive way, because he's also someone who practices what he preaches as much as he can.
And if you take John Loughran or Michael Apple, is there any particular book by either of them that you would recommend for people who want to be introduced to their work?
There is one book of Michael Apple about power and education. And the best book for John Loughran would be A Pedagogy of Teacher Education. And he has a nice book with Amanda Berry. She's also very inspiring. And that's called Explicit Modeling in Teacher Education.
What from your own experience of primary or secondary education influences your practice today?
I was in secondary education. Not even that long, only a few years. It was not the age for me, so I'm not sure. I had colleagues at that time, you know, the students are 12, 13, 14, 15. And then I remember one particular colleague, and he said to me, "Oh, I'm so happy," he said. "We have nearly our sailing week." You know, they went sailing with a group of students, all third years or something, like, you know, 15 years full of hormones. And the only thing I could think was, no, 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 no. I don't like to go sailing with third-year students. Our third-year students are 15, say.
This is when you were teaching in secondary.
Yes. Yeah. I learned that the age was not really mine. So I must say, I saw too many teachers who were not very inspired. So what I learned was, I want to like teaching. I want to go into a classroom and be happy that I can do this work. So I think I learned that, not so much a trick or anything. And of course, sometimes you don't feel very happy or you're ill or whatever. I mean,
that's life.
That's life. But on the whole, even now, if I go into a classroom, you know, I step over the threshold and here we are teaching. And that's something I think I learned maybe from this teacher who said, "Ooh, we're going on sailing camp." I think the word sailing camp. And I thought, no, no, no. But I liked his enthusiasm, his involvement. And I found that when I started working in teacher education. This was the age, the teachers in my classroom. I loved that. Like other people, like love kindergarten, other love teenagers, I love the teachers in my classroom.
It certainly helps a teacher educator when they love the student teachers in their classroom, as expressed by Anja Svennen from the University of Amsterdam. Now I'm pleased to bring you an interview with another teacher educator, this time from Glasgow in Scotland. Kay Livingstone is a professor in educational research, policy and practice at the University of Glasgow.
Along with colleagues from 14 countries who are members of a research and development community of the Association for Teacher Education of Europe, she has been studying the characteristics of innovative teachers, the conditions that enabled them, and how such innovation was evident in the classroom. Kay told me about the study.
We prepared a protocol so that we could have a rigorous methodology, and each of the people who were engaged in the research asked the same question with some prompts. At the same time, some people felt, in order to understand the conditions that allowed innovative teachers to flourish, we also need to interview school leaders. So some of the group opted to interview the school leaders about conditions that enable them to flourish. At the same time, some people felt, well, we really need to understand what are teacher educators doing to help enable school leaders and teachers to be innovative and to flourish. So some opted to interview teacher educators. So we had these three elements in terms of teachers, school leaders and teacher educators. And back came data from 14 countries. So we then set up an analytical group because each of the countries had undergone the ethical approval in their own country to undertake the data. They maintained the raw results, but what they sent to us was the story of the interview, and we had a protocol for putting together the stories. So in effect, we had stories from across Europe of innovation. And we had an analytical framework where we then distributed them anonymously, obviously, to people who had opted to be part of the analysis process. So if you and I had opted to be the analysis process, you would have received five stories. You wouldn't have known which country they came from. And I would have received five, but neither of us knew that each other was analysing the same, so that we got some rigour in the analysis process. And what astounded us is when we looked across the four countries, the the similarities in the characteristics across the countries was incredible. And even the actual quotations, so if we lifted a quote from one of the stories, somebody else could easily say, oh, that was a quote from one that I interviewed, because even the words, you know, whether it was the Netherlands or whether it was Portugal or whether it was Scotland, whether it was Turkey, you know, all the different countries, the similarity in the characteristics was totally surprising for us.
So what does innovative teaching look like across Europe?
Well, we had words like bold. We had words like willing to take risks. We had words like thinking outside the box. We had words like moving outside subject boundaries. We had words like eccentric. That was one that surprised us. The characteristics and the long list of characteristics that we came up with, as I say, it's been surprising how similar they are across the country. So it's a five-year plan that we've got, because also we went beyond. If someone said one of the characteristics was being able to take risks, the prompt that they were then asked was, give me an example of what that looks like in the classroom. So we're at the stage now where we want to actually take these examples and be able to try and make sense of them against the characteristics, so that ultimately we want to get to the stage where we're able to use these examples to think about how best to support teachers. First of all, we find the characteristics and the conditions. Now we're really into analysing the examples. And next year, what we hope is we'll be able to really do something about, OK, where do we go now in terms of thinking about supporting teachers?
And why was it innovative that was valued? Because very often we'd hear about effective teachers. Why did you choose innovative?
Well, again, that was a huge discussion, and it really came out of professional development for teachers to do what? You know, is it to be effective? Is it to meet a certain lot of standards? Is it to think about performativity? Or is it more than that? Let's think about teachers that have that sense of agency. And again, when we analyse the data, the thing that came through so strongly was this sense of engagement with learners, but the sense of empowerment to be able to make decisions in the classroom, the sense of agency that they could make a difference for the young people they were working with, the sense of connecting what they were doing in the classroom to the context in which they were working, the sense of commitment to what they were doing, the sense of dedication to the young people that they were working with. And again, that wasn't in one country or two countries or three countries. We saw that across the spectrum. So there's something that's really powerful in terms of what we were doing. And I think what's interesting, at the same time, the European Commission had commissioned a project to look at innovation in European schools. So we did a symposium at the conference in Croatia last year, but we did it jointly with the European Commission, one of the officers from the European Commission. So we were able to then look at even broader, to set our 14 countries within that piece of work that had been done across the European Union. And again, the similarities in the data was really interesting. So we're not at the end yet. It's still moving forward. There's more of the story still to tell. And I think the whole purpose of what we want to do is to really try and support teachers. And so we've now got a much better sense of the detail. So if you remember, I'm saying that we started at the beginning feeling it was such a slippery and that one size couldn't possibly fit all and all of this. Now we've got a much finer grain detail of what that actually means and what, you know, what does risk-taking or boldness or eccentric actually mean. And we're just waiting for the moment where we can really get our head into these examples so that we can have much stronger evidence base to be able to say, here's the kinds of supports that we can give for innovation.
And finally, Kay, what can principals do to provide the conditions for innovative teaching?
Yeah, well, again, the data was very interesting from school leaders, because on the one hand, the school leaders themselves had to have the characteristics to allow teachers to flourish. Because some of the head teachers were saying, well, to have one teacher who's taking risks or disrupting the notion of what is going on in the classrooms, actually, in terms of the dynamic of their staff, can be quite difficult for them to handle. And others were really, you know, saying, this is fantastic, you know, and it's a real boost to the dynamics.
And that was Kay Livingston from the University of Glasgow. You can listen back to podcasts of this and previous programmes by going to seandelaney.com and clicking on the Podcasts tab. My book about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, is available directly from the publisher, Routledge, or from any online bookstore. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.